Good evening, and welcome to Reading the Classics with the Ketchikan Public Library. This is Kelly Johnson, and this evening I'll be continuing the story of Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, by Mary Shelley. Before I begin, I'd like to briefly mention that despite the uncertainty in the world in the past few years, KRVD has been a reliable resource. Information as well as entertainment is so very important, and KRVD provides both to our community. Listener support is the mainstay of KRVD's funding, so please help them continue doing what they do so well. Give online at krvd.org or call during business hours at 907-225-9655. And now to the story. Previously, Victor had received word of a tragedy in his family and is now returning to Geneva. Clerval spoke thus as we hurried through the streets. The words impressed themselves on my mind, and I remembered them afterwards in solitude. But now, as soon as the horses arrived, I hurried into a cabriolet and bade farewell to my friend. My journey was very melancholy. At first I wished to hurry on, for I longed to console and sympathize with my loved and sorrowing friends. But when I drew near my native town, I slackened my progress. I could hardly sustain the multitude of feelings that crowded into my mind. I passed through scenes familiar to my youth, but which I had not seen for nearly 6 years. How altered everything might be during that time! One sudden and desolating change had taken place, but a thousand little circumstances might have by degree worked other alterations, which, although they were done more tranquilly, might not be the less decisive. Fear overcame me, and I dared not advance, dreading a thousand nameless evils that made me tremble, although I was unable to define them. I remained 2 days at Lausanne in this painful state of mind. I contemplated the lake, the waters that were placid, all around was calm, and the snowy mountains, the palaces of nature, were not changed. By degree, the calm and heavenly scene restored me, and I continued my journey toward Geneva. The road ran by the side of the lake, which became narrow as I approached my native town. I discovered more distinctly the black sides of Jura, the bright summit of Mont Blanc. I wept like a child. Dear mountains, my own beautiful lake, how do you welcome your wanderer? Your summits are clear, the sky and lake are blue and placid. Is this to procrastinate peace or to mock my unhappiness? I fear, my friend, that I shall render myself tedious by dwelling on these preliminary circumstances, but they were days of comparative happiness, and I think of them with pleasure. My country, my beloved country, who but a native can tell the delight I took in again beholding thy streams, thy mountains, and more than all, thy lovely lake. Yet as I drew nearer home, grief and fear again overcame me. Night also closed around, and when I could hardly see the dark mountains, I felt still more gloomily. The picture appeared a vast and dim scene of evil, and I foresaw obscurely that I was destined to become the most wretched of human beings. Alas, I prophesied truly and failed only in one single circumstance, that in all the misery I imagined and dreaded, I did not conceive of the hundredth part of anguish I was destined to endure. It was completely dark when I arrived in the environs of Geneva. The gates of the town were already shut, and I was obliged to pass the night at Sectron, a village at a distance of half a league from the city. The scene was serene, and as I was unable to rest, I resolved to visit the spot where my poor William had been murdered. As I could not pass through the town, I was obliged to cross the lake in a boat to arrive at Plain Place. During the short voyage, I saw the lightnings playing on the summit of Mont Blanc in the most beautiful figures. The storm appeared to approach rapidly, and on landing, I ascended a low hill that I might observe its progress. It advanced, the heavens were clouded, and I soon felt the rain coming slowly in large drops, but its violence quickly increased. I quitted my seat and walked on, although the darkness and storm increased every minute, and the thunder burst with a terrific crash over my head. It was echoed from Salive, the Durus, and the Alps of Savoy. Vivid flashes of lightning dazzled my eyes, illuminating the lake, making it appear like a vast sheet of fire. Then, for an instant, everything seemed of a pithy darkness until the eye recovered itself from the preceding flash. The storm, as is often the case in Switzerland, appeared at once in various parts of the heavens. The most violent storm hung exactly north of the town, over that part of the lake which lies between the promontory of Bellerive and the village of Coppet. Another storm enlightened Jura with faint flashes, and another darkened and sometimes disclosed the mole, a peaked mountain to the east of the lake. While I watched the tempest, so beautiful yet terrific, I wandered on with a hasty step. This noble war in the sky elevated my spirits. I clasped my hands and exclaimed aloud, "William, dear angel, this is thy funeral, this thy dirge." As I said these words, I perceived in the gloom a figure which stole from behind a clump of trees near me. I stood fixed, gazing intently. I could not be mistaken. A flash of lightning illuminated the object and discovered its shape plainly to me, its gigantic stature and the deformity of its aspects, more hideous than belongs to humanity, instantly informed me that it was the wretch, the filthy daemon to whom I had given life. What did he there? Could he be? I shuddered at the conception. The murderer of my brother? No sooner did that idea cross my imagination than I became convinced of its truth. My teeth chattered and I was forced to lean against a tree for support. The figure passed me quickly and I lost it in the gloom. Nothing in human shape could have destroyed that fair child. He was the murderer. I could not doubt it. The mere presence of the idea was irresistible proof of the fact. I thought of pursuing the devil, but it would have been in vain, for another flash discovered him to me hanging among the rocks of the nearly perpendicular ascent of Mount Sauve, a hill that bound Plain Palace on the south. He soon reached the summit and quickly disappeared. I remained motionless. The thunder ceased, but the rain still continued, and the scene was enveloped in impenetrable darkness. I resolved in my mind the events which I had until now sought to forget. The whole train of my progress toward the creation, the appearance of the work of my own hands alive at my bedside, its departure. 2 years had now nearly elapsed since the night on which he first received life, and was this his first crime? Alas, I had turned loose into the world a depraved wretch whose delight was in carnage and misery. Had he not murdered my brother? No one can conceive the anguish I suffered during the remainder of the night, which I spent cold and wet in the open air. But I did not feel the inconvenience of the weather. My imagination was busy in scenes of evil and despair. I considered the being whom I had cast among mankind and endowed with the will and the power to effect purposes of horror, such as the deed which he had now done. Nearly in the light of my own vampire, with my own spirit let loose from the grave and forced to destroy all that was dear to me. Day dawned, and I directed my step towards the town. The gates were open, and I hastened to my father's house. My first thought was to discover what I knew of the murderer and cause instant pursuit to be made, but I paused when I reflected on the story I had to tell. A being who I myself had formed and endued with life had met me at midnight among the precipices of an inaccessible mountain. I remembered also the nervous fever with which I had been seized just at the time that I had dated my creation, and which would give an air of delirium to a tale otherwise so utterly improbable. I well knew that if any other had communicated such a relation to me, I should have looked upon it as the ravings of insanity. Besides, the strange nature of the animal would elude all pursuit, even if I were so far credited as to persuade my relatives to commence it. And then what of use would be pursuit? Who would arrest a creature capable of scaling the overhanging sides of Mont Salive? These reflections determined me, and I resolved to remain silent. It was about 5 in the morning when I entered my father's house. I told the servants not to disturb the family and went into the library to attend their usual hour of rising. 6 years had elapsed, passed as a dream, but for one indelible trace, and I stood in the same place where I'd last embraced my father before my departure for Ingolstadt. Beloved and venerable parent, he still remained to me. I gazed on the picture of my mother, which stood over the mantelpiece. It was an historical subject, painted at my father's desire, and represented Caroline Buford in an agony of despair, kneeling by the coffin of her dead father. Her garb was rustic and her cheek pale, but there was an air of dignity and beauty that hardly permitted the sentiment of pity. Below this picture was a miniature of William, and my tears flowed when I looked upon it. While I was thus engaged, Ernest entered. He had heard me arrive and hastened to welcome me. He expressed a sorrowful delight to see me. "Welcome, my dearest Victor," he said. "I wish you'd come 3 months ago when you have found us all joyous and delighted. You come now to us to share a misery which nothing can alleviate. Yet your presence will, I hope, revive our father, who seems sinking under his misfortune, and your persuasions will induce poor Elizabeth to cease her vain and tormenting self-accusations. Poor William, he was our darling and our pride." Tears unrestrained fell from my brother's eyes. A sense of moral agony crept over my frame. Before I had only imagined the wretchedness of my desolate home, the reality came to me as new and not less terrible disaster. I tried to calm Ernest. I inquired more minutely concerning my father, and her I named my cousin. "She, most of all," said Ernest, "requires consolation. She accused herself of having caused the death of my brother, and that has made her very wretched. But since the murder has been discovered..." "The murder discovered? Good God, how can that be? Who could attempt to pursue him? It is impossible. One might as well try to overtake the winds or confine a mountain stream with straw. I saw him, too. He was free last night." "I do not know what you mean," replied my brother in accents of wonder. "But to us, the discovery we have made completes our misery. No one would believe at first, and even now Elizabeth will not be convinced, notwithstanding all the evidence. Indeed, who would credit that Justine Moritz, who was so amiable and fond of the family, could suddenly become capable of so frightful, so appalling a crime?" "Justine! Poor, poor girl! Is she the accused? But it is wrongfully. Everyone knows that. No one believes it, surely, Ernest." "No one did at first, but several circumstances came out that have almost forced conviction upon us, and her own behavior has been so confused as to add to the evidence of facts a weight that, I fear, leaves no hope for doubt. But she will be tried today, and you will hear all then." He related that, the morning on which the murder of poor William had been discovered, Justine had been taken ill and confined to her bed for several days. During this interval, one of the servants, happening to examine the apparel she had worn on the night of the murder, had discovered in her pocket the picture of my mother, which had been judged to be the temptation of the murderer. The servant instantly showed it to one of the others, who, without saying a word to any of the family, went to a magistrate, and upon their deposition Justine was apprehended. On being charged with the fact, the poor girl confirmed the suspicion in great measure by her extreme confusion of manner. This was a strange tale, but it did not shake my faith, and I replied earnestly, "You are all mistaken. I know the murderer. Justine, poor good Justine, is innocent." At that instant my father entered. I saw unhappiness deeply impressed on his countenance, but he endeavored to welcome me cheerfully, and after we had exchanged our mournful greeting, would have introduced some other topic than that of our disaster, had not Ernest exclaimed, "Good God, Papa, Victor says he knows who is the murderer of poor William." "We do also, unfortunately," replied my father, "for indeed I have rather have ever been ignorant than discovered so much depravity and ingratitude in one I valued so highly." "My dear father, you are mistaken. Justine is innocent." If she is, God forbid that she should suffer as guilty. She is to be tried today, and I hope, sincerely hope, that she will be acquitted. This speech calmed me. I was firmly convinced in my own mind that Justine, and indeed every human being, was guiltless of the murder. I had no fear, therefore, that any circumstantial evidence could be brought forward strong enough to convict her. My tale was not one to announce publicly, and its astounding horror would be looked upon as madness by the vulgar. Did anyone indeed exist except I, the Creator, who would believe, unless his senses convinced him, in the existence of a living monument of presumption and a rash of ignorance which I had left loose upon the world? We were soon joined by Elizabeth. Time had altered her since I last beheld her. It endowed her with a loveliness surpassing the beauty of her childish years. There was the same candor, the same vivacity, but it was allied to an expression more full of sensibility and intellect. She welcomed me with the greatest affection. "Your arrival, my dear cousin," said she, "fills me with hope. You perhaps will find some means to justify my poor guiltless Justine. Alas, who is safe if she be convicted of the crime? I rely on her innocence as certainly I do upon my own. Our misfortune is doubly hard to us. We have not only lost that lovely darling boy, but this poor girl, who I sincerely love, is to be torn away by even worse a fate. If she is condemned, I never shall know more joy. But she will not, I am sure she will not, and then I shall be happy again, even after the sad death of my little William." "She is innocent, my Elizabeth," I said, "and that shall be proved. Fear nothing, but let your spirit be cheered by the assurance of her acquittal." "How kind and generous you are! Everyone else believes in her guilt, and that made me wretched, for I knew that it was impossible, and to see everyone else prejudiced in so deadly a manner rendered me hopeless and despairing," she wept. "Dearest niece and my father, dry your tears. If she is, as you believe, innocent, rely on the justice of our laws and the activity with which I shall prevent the slightest shadow of partiality." Chapter 8. We passed a few sad hours until 11 o'clock, when the trial was to commence. My father and the rest of the family being obliged to attend as witnesses, I accompanied them to the court. During the whole of this wretched mockery of justice, I suffered living torture. It was to be decided whether the result of my curiosity and lawless devices would cause the death of my fellow beings, one a smiling babe full of innocence and joy, the other far more dreadfully murdered, with every aggravation of infamy that can make a murder memorable in horror. Justine was also a girl of merit and possessed qualities which promised to render her happy life. Now all was to be obliterated in an ignominious grave, and I the cause. 1,000 times, rather, would I have confessed myself guilty of the crime ascribed to Justine, but I was absent when it was committed, and such a declaration would have been considered as the ravings of a madman, and would not have exculpated her who suffered through me. The appearance of Justine was calm. She was dressed in mourning, and her countenance, always engaging, was rendered by the solemnity of her feelings, exquisitely beautiful. Yet she appeared confident in innocence and did not tremble, although gazed on and execrated by thousands, for all the kindness which her beauty might otherwise have excited was obliterated in the minds of the spectators by the imagination of the enormity she was supposed to have committed. She was tranquil, yet her tranquillity was evidently constrained, and as her confusion had been before, added as proof of her guilt. She worked up her mind in appearance of courage. When she entered the court, she threw her eyes around and quickly discovered where we were seated. A tear seemed to dim her eye when she saw us, but she quickly recovered herself, and a look of sorrow affection seemed to attest her utter guiltlessness. The trial began, and after the advocate against her had stated her charge, several witnesses were called. Several strange facts combined against her, which might have staggered anyone who had not such proof of her innocence as I had. She had been out the whole of the night on which the murder had been committed, and towards morning had been perceived by a market woman not far from the spot where the body of the murdered child had been afterwards found. The woman asked her what she did there, but she looked very strangely and only returned a confused and unintelligible answer. She returned to the house about 8 o'clock, and when one inquired where she had passed the night, she replied that she had been looking for the child and demanded earnestly if anything had been heard concerning him. When shown the body, she fell into violent hysterics and kept her bed for several days. The picture was then produced, which the servant had found in her pocket, and when Elizabeth, in a faltering voice, proved that it was the same which an hour before the child had been missed, she had placed round his neck, a murmur of horror and indignation filled the court. Justine was called on for her defense. As the trial proceeded, her countenance had altered. Surprise, horror, and misery were strongly expressed. Sometimes she struggled with tears, but when she was desired to plead, she collected her powers and spoke in an audible, though variable, voice. "God knows," she said, "how entirely innocent I am, but I do not pretend that my protestations should acquit me. I rest my innocence on a plain and simple explanation of the facts which have been added against me, and I hope the character I have always borne with incline my judges to a favorable interpretation where any circumstance appears doubtful or suspicious." She then related that by permission of Elizabeth she had passed the evening of the night on which the murder had been committed at the house of an aunt in Chaine, a village situation at about a league from Geneva. On her return, about 9 o'clock, she met a man who asked if she had seen anything of the child who was lost. She was alarmed by this account and passed several hours in looking for him. When the gates of Geneva were shut and she was forced to remain several hours of the night in a barn belonging to a cottage, being unwilling to call up the inhabitants to whom she was well known. Most of the night she spent here watching. Towards morning she believed that she slept for a few moments, and some steps disturbed her and she woke. It was dawn, and she quitted her asylum, that she might again endeavor to find my brother. If she had gone near the spot where his body lay, it was without her knowledge. That she had been bewildered when she was questioned by the market woman was not surprising, since she had passed a sleepless night, and the fate of poor William was yet uncertain. Concerning the picture, she could give no account. "I know," continued the unhappy victim, "how heavily and fatally this one circumstance weighs against me, but I have no power of explaining it, and when I have expressed my utter ignorance, I am left only to conjecture concerning the probabilities by which it might have been placed in my pocket. But here also I am checked. I believe that I have no enemy on earth, and none surely would have been so wicked as to destroy me wantonly. Did the murderer place it there? I know of no opportunity afforded him for doing so, or if I had, why would he have stolen the jewel to part with it again so soon? I commit my cause to the justice of my judges, yet I see no room for hope. I beg permission to have a few witnesses examined concerning my character, and if their testimony shall not outweigh my supposed guilt, I must be condemned, although I would pledge my salvation on my innocence." Several witnesses were called who had known her for many years, and they spoke well of her, but fear and hatred of the crime of which they supposed her guilty rendered them timorous and unwilling to come forward. Elizabeth saw even this last resource, her excellent disposition and irreproachable conduct, about to fail the accused when, although violently agitated, she desired permission to address the court. "I am," said she, "the cousin of the unhappy child who was murdered, or rather his sister, for I was educated by and have lived with his parents ever since and even long before his birth. It may, therefore, be judged indecent in me to come forward on this occasion, but when I see a fellow creature about to perish through the cowardice of her pretended friends, I wish to be allowed to speak, that I may say what I know of her character. I am well acquainted with the accused. I have lived in the same house with her, at one time for 5 and another for nearly 2 years. During all that period, she appeared to me the most amiable and benevolent of human creatures. She nursed Madame Frankenstein, my aunt, in her last illness with the greatest affection and care, and afterwards attended her own mother during a tedious illness in a manner that exceeded the admiration of all who knew her. After which she again lived in my uncle's house, where she was beloved by all the family. She was warmly attached to the child who is now dead, and acted towards him like a most affectionate mother. For my own part, I do not hesitate to say that, notwithstanding all the evidence produced against her, I believe and rely on her perfect innocence. She had no temptation for such an action. As to the bauble on which the chief proof rests, if she had earnestly desired it, I should have willingly given it to her. So much do I esteem and value her. A murmur of approbation followed Elizabeth's simple and powerful appeal, but it was excited by her generous interference and not in favor of poor Justine, on whom the public indignation was turned with renewed violence, charging her with the blackest ingratitude. She herself wept as Elizabeth spoke, but she did not answer. My own agitation and anguish was extreme during the whole trial. I believed in her innocence. I knew it. Could the demon who had, I did not for a minute doubt, murdered my brother, also in his hellish sport, have betrayed the innocent to death and ignominy? I could not sustain the horror of my situation, and when I perceived that the popular voice and countenance of the judges had already condemned my unhappy victim, I rushed out of the court in agony. The tortures of the accused did not equal mine. She was sustained by innocence, but the fangs of remorse tore at my bosom and would not forego their hold. I passed a night of unmingled wretchedness. In the morning I went to court. My lips and throat were parched. I dare not ask the fatal question, but I was known, and the officer guessed the cause of my visits. The ballots had been thrown. They were all black, and Justine was condemned. I cannot pretend to describe what I felt then. I had before experienced sensation of horror, and I have endeavored to bestow upon them adequate expressions, but words cannot convey an idea of the heart-sickening despair that I then endured. The person to whom I addressed myself added that Justine had already confessed her guilt. That evidence, he observed, was hardly required in so glaring a case. But I am glad of it, and indeed none of our judges like to condemn a criminal upon circumstantial evidence, be it ever so decisive. This was strange and unexpected intelligence. What could it mean? Had my own eyes deceived me? And was I really as mad as the whole world would believe me to be if I disclosed the object of my suspicion? I hastened to return home, and Elizabeth eagerly demanded the result. My cousin, I replied, it is decided as you may have expected. All the judges had rather than 10 innocent would suffer that one guilty should escape. But she has confessed. This was a dire blow to poor Elizabeth, who had relied with firmness upon Justine's innocence. Alas, she said, how shall I ever again believe in human goodness? Justine, whom I loved and esteemed as my sister, how could she put on those smiles of innocence only to betray? Her mild eyes seemed incapable of any severity or guile, and yet she has committed a murder? Soon after we heard that poor victim had expressed a desire to see my cousin. My father wished her not to go, but said that he left it to her own judgment and feelings to decide. Yes, said Elizabeth, I will go, although she is guilty, and you, Victor, shall accompany me. I cannot go alone. The idea of this visit was torture to me, and yet I could not refuse. Thank you for listening to Reading the Classics. I hope you have a lovely evening. Good night.